This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. Emergency crews are still searching for survivors after a wing of a 12-story beachfront condo building collapsed outside Miami on Thursday, killing at least one person. Authorities said late Thursday afternoon nearly 100 people were still unaccounted for, raising fears that the death toll could climb sharply. Officials did not know how many people were in the tower when it fell. Rescuers have pulled out dozens of survivors. Authorities did not say what might have caused the collapse. Some work was being done on the roof of the building, but it is not known if that was a factor in causing part of the building to come down. Authorities say a fire swept through a martial arts school in central China earlier today, killing 18 people, injuring 16 others, some seriously. The Associated Press reports the fire is out and police detained the person in charge of the school. An investigation is just getting underway into the cause of that fire. President Joe Biden will meet with Afghanistan President Ashraf Ghani and Chief Peacemaker Abdullah Abdullah at the White House later today. The first face-to-face interaction between Biden and Afghan officials comes ahead of the withdrawal of the remaining U.S. and NATO forces from Afghanistan by September 11th, in line with Biden's direction to close what he has described as the forever war. Ghani's aide said he would raise the issue of future ties between the two countries and continued assistance for Afghan security forces. For more news, as always, we invite you to join us at our website, voanews.com. Via remote, this is VOA News. The United States is planning to evacuate a group of vulnerable Afghan interpreters before the military completes its withdrawal from Afghanistan so they can wrap up their visa applications from safety. U.S. officials said Thursday the evacuation of the at-risk Afghans would include their family members for a total of as many as 50,000 people. President Biden says he is optimistic about reaching a bipartisan infrastructure deal. Following a meeting with Senate Democrats and Republicans, Biden said the bipartisan agreement for infrastructure legislation demonstrates that American democracy, can deliver. Money would go to things like roads and highways, broadband, and efforts to tackle climate change. Cast aside for now are other Biden priorities, such as money for child care. One of the main points of contention has been how to pay for the plan. Biden has advocated raising the corporate tax rate, but Republicans are opposed to that step, having successfully cut the rate during the previous administration. U.S. Vice President Kamala Harris will make her first visit later today to the U.S.-Mexico border since taking office, following criticism from members of both parties for failing to go earlier, despite her role leading the Biden administration's response to a steep increase in migration. So far, she's focused largely on outreach to local leaders and advocacy groups, with the goal of improving economic and living conditions in the Central American region. Harris has said her goal is to offer residents of Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, and Mexico hope for their future so they no longer feel compelled to leave home for better opportunities. Harris will arrive in the area just 2 days before former President Donald Trump is to visit the border with a group of House Republicans and Texas Republican Governor. Trump is certain to use the opportunity to drive Republican attacks on Democrats as soft on immigration. An official said Friday that parts of Sydney are set to go into lockdown before midnight after 22 more locally acquired virus cases were detected in Australia's largest city. The cluster has been blamed on the Delta variant and has grown to 65 cases as of Friday. For more news, please join us at our website, voanews.com, or the VOA mobile app. I'm Michael Brown, reporting by remote, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Friday, June the 25th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you this morning. The UN says that violence in the DRC's Ituri province continues to displace thousands of children.
It's estimated that in the east of the DRC, there are about 5 million people who are displaced. And of those 5 million, 3 million are children.
That is Alastair Lawson, the UNICEF spokesperson in the DRC. More with him later on in the show. And dialogue continues between the government of Burundi and the European Union regarding the lifting of sanctions on the country.
The meeting focused on human rights, and I think it's a good sign for the further deepening of the relationship between Burundi and EU.
Claude Bochu is the European Union ambassador to Burundi, and the new vaccine rollout in West Africa and Central Africa is hoping to get more than 400,000 people in vulnerable situations, such as displaced and refugees, their COVID-19 vaccines. We'll have those stories plus sports coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. And for our top story, we start off in the DRC, where the UN is calling for an end to the violence in Ituri province, while at the same time appealing for urgent resources to help the thousands of people, especially children, who have been separated from their parents as they flee violent attacks on their villages of Boga and Chabi. UNICEF says that conflict in the eastern part of the DRC has caused one of the world's worst humanitarian crises, displacing over 5 million people in the country. UNICEF spokesman Alastair Lawson says that in this particular case, displaced children have had to trek hundreds of miles to Bunia, the capital of Ituri province, to seek for safety.
Conditions for children in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo are dire. I don't think anybody would disagree with that, especially for children who've been displaced. It's estimated that in the east of the DRC, there are about 5 million people who are displaced. And of those 5 million, 3 million are children. And in the province we visited, Ituri, we came across a whole new round of displacements, 30,000 people displaced from two towns. A lot of those people had made their way to the provincial capital, Bunia. More had gone to go and stay with friends and families in what's called the host communities. But for those people who are displaced who don't have friends and families to go and stay with, they tend to go to camps. There are two very large camps in Bunia, each together holding about 20,000 people. And the girl that we followed, a 12-year-old, had been displaced from a town about 100 kilometres from Bunia. She'd had to find her own transport to get to Bunia. She was unaccompanied. Her parents had been killed earlier. She was living with her grandmother. And during the attack by an armed group, she was separated from her grandmother and had no choice but to find her own transport to Bunia and went into a very large camp for displaced people entirely by herself. So you can imagine how traumatic that would be for a small child.
Absolutely. And what is fueling this conflict? Who are the people perpetuating this violence?
It's a very tricky question, because in the east of Congo, there are various armed groups, some of whom have political or ideological objectives. Others, I'm afraid, a little more than criminal groups. But in each part of each rural area of the east of the DRC, the likelihood is that some armed groups or several armed groups are operating. For example, we have what's known as the Allied Democratic Front, the ADF, who are accused of being an Islamic group. There isn't an awful lot of evidence to suggest that they're jihadists, but they certainly have Islamic sympathies. And then there are other groups fighting for local autonomy, other groups fighting for the promotion of their particular tribal group or their particular community group, for them to have more influence. So it's a very complicated mishmash of armed groups that operate in this part of the world.
And what needs to be done in the short term and, you know, I guess ultimately in the long term, to avoid further suffering of these children? I assume that aside from finding immediate safety and food, that there are other things that need to be done for their rehabilitation and eventual resettlement.
Yes, I think for children like the 12-year-old I was telling you about, they need psychosocial support, you know, for the trauma they've witnessed. There's an awful lot of children here who've witnessed trauma, children who've witnessed machete attacks, children who've seen their villages attacked with bullets flying in the air and people being killed. So those children need some kind of psychosocial support. Beyond that, I think on a sort of wider scale, there's an urgent necessity for the Congolese government and the Congolese army to establish some degree of law and order in areas of the country, especially in the east, where they have absolutely no control.
And what is UNICEF doing to reunite these children with their parents? What kind of resources is UNICEF seeking or asking for from the international community?
To reunite children is problematic because invariably what happens is that the children who have fled areas of fighting, and because they fled the areas of fighting, it's quite difficult for aid agencies to go there. But again, referring to the 12-year-old I was telling you about, UNICEF are trying to reunite her, the 12-year-old, with her grandmother. The trouble is no one knows where the grandmother's gone, or I'm afraid, even if she's still alive. So that's what they're trying to do in the short term, and they'll do that by either providing the children with a foster family who can look after them until they can be reunited, or in some cases where there's no chance of them being reunited, there'll be various centres operated by UNICEF and its partners that look after children who are effectively orphaned. As far as the response from the international community is concerned, there's a shortage of cash here. I mean, the UN, the overall UN effort to help displaced people in the East is chronically underfunded. It has less than half the amount of funds it needs. So UNICEF is looking for funding, and other UN agencies are looking for funding from the international community. And I think that the part of the problem is there's a sense of compassion fatigue here, because the problems of Eastern Congo have dragged on for a long time. They're decades old. And there might be that some donors are sort of thinking, well, it's gone on for so long, it doesn't make any difference if we provide money. But it does make a difference, and it makes a difference to the 12-year-old child I was telling you about, because without that funding, she'd have received no help whatsoever. She's not receiving a great deal as it is, but at least she's receiving something, and that's largely thanks to the efforts of the international community and Congolese NGOs who are working on her behalf.
That was UNICEF spokesman Alistair Lawson. He joined me from the DRC's capital, Kinshasa. And Burundi and the European Union ended their third political dialogue session in Bujumbura. The dialogue is part of the efforts for the European Union to lift sanctions imposed on Burundi since 2015. Moses Habyarimana reports from Arusha.
The European Union and Burundi concluded the third political dialogue session that is aimed towards lifting sanctions imposed by the European Union on Burundi 6 years ago, after the government was accused of gross human rights violations during the protests against former President Pierre Nkurunziza's third term. Claude Boshu is the European Union ambassador to Burundi.
This session came after the visit of the Minister of Foreign Affairs to Europe, which we examined, and that visit was the first one in a 5 years period. The meeting focused on human rights, and I think it's a good sign for the further deepening of the relationship between Burundi and EU. So I'm personally pleased with the results of today.
Article 96 of the Cotonou Agreement provides legal basis of suspension of the agreement following a period of dialogue in cases where one of the parties feels that the agreement is essential and fundamental elements are not respected. That includes human rights abuses and activities that undermines democracy. Albert Shingiro is Burundi's foreign affairs minister. He says that European Union showed the political will to lift sanctions and that the situation in his country improved significantly. He says that all measures being taken which is related to the human rights and good governance is being done for the good of Burundians, and that it is done for Burundians. Burundi's leading opposition leader, Agathon Rwasa, believes that the country still has a long way to go in as far as human rights and democracy is concerned.
The most important right of any human being is the right for life. And just consider how many people
are killed, kidnapped, or disappearing in this way or that other one. CNL, regardless the position it has in the country, is 100% discriminated. If a regime is just based on discrimination, how can one pretend that there is good governance and that there is improvement?
Among the European Union demand to lift the sanctions that impose on Burundi includes press freedom. Since President Evariste Ndayishimiye took the office last year, his government took positive measures towards media freedom, including granting amnesty to local journalists and the reopening of some local media houses. However, some international media houses still do not operate in Burundi, including the Voice of America. Moses Havyarimana, VOA Africa, Arusha, Tanzania.
A new vaccine rollout in West and Central Africa is hoping to get more than 400,000 people in vulnerable situations, such as displaced and refugees, their COVID-19 vaccines. The Alliance for International Medical Action, ALIMA, with support from the European Union, will increase their operations in hard-to-reach areas. ALIMA's head of mission in Nigeria, Dr. Abdel Kadar Esale, spoke to Ricky Shryok about the details.
In six countries, including Burkina Faso, Mali, Mauritania, Niger, Central African Republic, and here in Nigeria. So what we are targeting is they would like to ensure the equity of the vaccine delivery within all the countries. That means no rich country, no poor country, all the countries to access to vaccine, especially for poor countries. They are expected to reach 20% of the population. So we say within, we are, all our intervention is in countries, especially West and Central Africa, and in very, very difficult context of vulnerability. So we say within the country, now that the vaccine is available, make it accessible for vulnerable population, especially internally displaced and refugees.
How will you guys work to address vaccine skepticism, which is quite high in a lot of communities in West Africa, and, you know, rooted in very real critiques of public health, both international and on a local level, I think, and the way they've interacted with the public in the past?
Clearly, we are not only, we have some experience already with Ebola, work with the community, and even for the COVID-19 management, we were there with those countries. So we chose to, our intervention to focus on our intervention area. We are already there. We know the community, so we are going to focus of this on this knowledge and the lesson learned from Ebola intervention and COVID-19 management vaccination to approach the community. There is some challenges that we are looking. There is a special rumor against vaccine, especially this AstraZeneca.
That was Dr. Abdel Kadar Esale, the head of mission for the Alliance for International Medical Action, ALIMA, in Nigeria. He was speaking to VOA's Ricky Shryok. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. And we stay in West Africa, in Nigeria, Africa's most populous nation, where misinformation and misconceptions are contributing to apathy towards vaccination against COVID-19. From Lagos, Samuel Okocha reports on what residents are saying and efforts of authorities to scale up vaccination efforts.
In March this year, Nigeria received nearly 4 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine. Authorities say they will vaccinate around 80 million people by the end of the year. But so far, less than 1 million people have received full vaccination with the required two shots.
I've not been vaccinated, and I don't think I want to take that vaccine.
That's Mabel, a resident in Lagos. She is one of many citizens with apathy towards the COVID vaccination.
I've heard a lot about it. I'm not ready for my body system to be changed. And then there are so many effects. And another thing I actually heard that made me kind of discouraged from taking the vaccine is that whether you take it or not, It doesn't stop the virus, you from contacting the virus. So whether I take the viral vaccine or not, I'll still get the virus. So what's the point taking the vaccine that will now turn my system upside down? So, I mean, I'm not ready for that vaccine as far as it is concerned in Nigeria, especially.
Mabel Kanu is not alone in her apathy. Although health authorities have explained that the COVID vaccine is not a full protection against the contraction of the virus, it, however, provides protection against illness that results in complications that can lead to death. But some Nigerians have continued to show reluctance towards the vaccination exercise.
I have not taken the vaccine because of the process involving the registration. I don't even know where to start, you know, to log. When I look at how to register, I'll keep on saying tomorrow, today, tomorrow, the next tomorrow, or something like that.
I expect that the company which I am working on that should bring the vaccine in the company so that the staff can partake in the vaccine. That's why I've not been able to take the vaccine.
Nigeria needs to vaccinate about 150 million of its people by next year to attain herd immunity, but only less than 1% of the population have so far received vaccination. That's lower than the global average of 10%, according to records from the World Health Organization. The Lagos State Health Commissioner, Professor Akin Abayomi, has highlighted vaccination as one of the strategies to curb the spread of the coronavirus in the states.
When we get somebody that has turned positive, who has recently returned from abroad, and you have tested positive, then we will be deploying some of the vaccines to vaccinate members of their family, their immediate household, to stop the transmission of the virus from the traveler to family members or people that live in the same home or in the same immediate jurisdiction.
In a statement released on Wednesday, the Lagos State Minister of Health said it was encouraging everybody that has had their first dose to go for their second dose to be fully immunized. According to Nigeria's National Primary Healthcare Development Agency, the country is due to get another nearly 4 million doses of COVID-19 vaccine by the end of July or early August. As Nigeria ramps up vaccination efforts, authorities will need to intensify efforts to combat hesitancy among citizens. Samuel Okocha, VOA News, Lagos, Nigeria.
And we go to East Africa in Kenya, where a report commissioned by Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta found that at least 160,000 girls aged 15 to 19 years were married off and others impregnated between June 2020 and February of 2021. The team, which examined the impact of COVID-19 on education in the country, say that 370,000 learners didn't resume school in January of this year due to lack of school fees, the majority being girls. Maureen Ojambo has more.
Kenya's President Uhuru Kenyatta is expected to release a study report titled Promises to Keep Impact of COVID-19 on Adolescents. This is after hundreds of thousands of learners failed to resume learning in January this year following socioeconomic impacts that was as a result of COVID-19 lockdowns. Rukia Hamisi Juma has an organization that supports teenagers who are not able to go back to school for lack of school fees. Rukia says most of the girls she supports are those who got pregnant while in school and dropped out, as well as boys who fell in the risk of substance abuse.
My first priority was working with the girls who happened to get expectant since early last year during the COVID season. And some are not capable of getting the fees. And with the boys, actually the boys have been highly neglected within the community. That's why they don't have that self-esteem. They don't have the guidance and counseling from anyone. So it happens that they are not stable. They don't have a choice to make. They have no option. They end up in the peer pressure groups. They engage into theft and drugs. And that also drives them off from going to school.
The closure of learning institutions in March 2020 to curb the spread of COVID-19 in Kenya led to dropping out of over 375,000 learners in primary and secondary schools. The lead report author, Julie Mwabe, agenda advisor at the Presidential Policy and Strategic Unit in Kenya, said that majority of young people between the age of 10 to 19 dropped out of school due to socioeconomic challenges.
Places like the northern part of Kenya, where access to education, online platforms or smartphones or just any of the digital devices for them to access education, I mean, it was a challenge across the country. So that's one of the things that we are looking at in terms of how do you ensure that even in the middle of a pandemic that children are able to access learning. At this moment when they're not learning, they fall really vulnerable to issues such as early marriage, FGM, drugs. We saw many boys say, let them go and work and earn a living. So a lot of them dropped out of school because of that.
The Ministry of Education Kenya has since put up measures to ensure all learners resume school despite the challenges. Mwabe said that most learners suffered from mental health problems during the lockdown period.
We were asking questions on that led us to, to sort of understand that there were a lot of depressive tendencies among young people. So it is just to sort of look at the facts, look at the numbers, the data, and see, how do we move forward? How do we ensure that this demographic doesn't continue, falling through the cracks, that they're able to sort of come up, go back to school? Even those who fell pregnant, that they're able to continue in school. We are really strengthening the systems around.
In the report, the impact of lockdown on learners was first seen during the administration of the Kenya Certificate of Primary Examination that saw at least 12,424 candidates miss the exams. Public health officials and women's rights advocates worry that the ongoing pandemic is delaying an adequate response to a growing sexual reproductive health crisis. Data from the International Rescue Committee also found that girls living in Kenya's refugee camps had been affected too. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Milwaukee, USA.
And now it's time for Daybreak Africa Sports. With that, we go to Abuja with Samson O'Malley. Good morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, Jackson. We begin the sports with the World Rally Championship holding in Kenya, making a return after a 19-year wait. This week's event is made up of 18 stages spanning 4 days. President Uhuru Kenyatta flagged off the 2021 World Rally Championship in Nairobi.
The Kwale Rally was first held in 1953 to commemorate the coronation of Her Royal Majesty Queen Elizabeth II. In 1973, Safari Rally gained admission to the International Automobile Federation World Rally Championship, thereby elevating it to the international event that we are again witnessing here today.
Seven-time world champion Frenchman Sebastian Auger will be one of the big favorites for this year's competition.
We have a lot of question mark of the condition we're going to get, especially on second pass probably, where road can be very, very rough, but we don't really have experience.
The rally will finish at the foot of Mount Kenya on Sunday. From car racing to football news, CAF Champions League title holders Al Hakli will face Tunisian giant Esperance in Egypt after they won the first leg at the Hamad Arabi Stadium in Raids 1-0. Al Hakli are just 2 matches away from securing the prestigious title for the second season in a row after achieving a positive result in Tunisia. In the other semi-final, Kaiser Chiefs of South Africa will be up against Wydad Casablanca at the FNP Stadium in Soweto. The first leg last week ended in a shock 1-0 win for the South African team. And staying with CAF, the former interim president of DR Congo's Confederation of African Football, Constant Omari, was on Thursday banned from all football-related activities for the next 12 months by FIFA's Independent Ethics Committee. This is the culmination of a lengthy investigation into the terms of a revised television contract signed in 2016 between CAF and the French marketing company Lagarde Sports. The revelations of the New York Times last November had prompted FIFA to open a formal procedure on January 7th. The revelation of the New York Times last November had prompted FIFA to open a formal procedure on January 7th. The CAF's one-time vice president is said to have received just over $80,000, which football's world governing body has instructed he pays as a fine as part of his sanction. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, Jackson, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. A very good morning to you. And that's it for this Friday, June 25th edition of Daybreak Africa. Join us again Monday for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Ricky Shryok, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you